For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Welcome to Let's Get Two, the baseball podcast from the fans' perspective. Now here's your host, James Christopher.
And welcome to Let's Get Two. I am your host, James Christopher, and we've got a great week ahead of you. We're going to be looking at minor league baseball from a lot of different angles, from a lot of different areas that I haven't actually had a chance to touch on the show, but had always kind of really been interested in. So we've got a great episode today and another great episode planned Friday. So we're really, really excited about it. Some of the guests we have on today's episode were pretty cool gets. And again, we're stoked. I do want to address some pushback, I guess, that I got after I introduced one of the shows on social media from last week when I referred to baseball as a game without integrity. And I'm not going to backtrack that, but I'll explain what I mean because I'm correct. Here's the thing. And it isn't that I don't love baseball. I dedicate an insane amount of time to this game and to this show. We produce about 120 minutes of content spread out across two episodes when we are really in the throes of the season. So we go to two episodes sometime around March, and we don't stop doing two episodes a week until after the World Series is done. And then we'll be one episode a week until after the winter meetings, and then up until basically when pitchers and catchers report. We are always doing this. And look, here's the thing. I do it because I love the game, and in some ways, following the game and trying to be tangentially associated with the game, a game I always loved playing, was never really good at, is a big part of how I stay sane in what this 2020 has been. Those of you who've watched the show know that I've got MILB memorabilia here, I've got Astros 2017 memorabilia there, still your World Series champions from 2017, but I've even got a 1986 NL West pennant on the wall, which does nothing but represent the biggest crushing sports defeat in the history of my history of being a fan. That and the 2009 national championship for the University of Texas, really, 86 crushed me more than the 2019 World Series. But it's still there because I still have memories of that. So look, me loving the game doesn't make me incapable of calling it as I see it. And I'll use a very weird analogy. I'm a Catholic. I have always been a Catholic. I teach at a Catholic school. My daughter was baptized Catholic. I love my church. I don't talk about it a lot, but I love my church. I think it's a very beautiful religion. But like most other things that are man-made or human-made, they're therefore subject to the same flaws that we as people have. And one doesn't need to watch the movie Spotlight to understand what I'm talking about. The game of baseball is the same way. We hold it up as this sanctity thing, this pure and virginal thing that should never be touched or damaged, lest we throw the whole world into asunder. When in fact, baseball's history is filled with anything other than integrity and sanctity. It is a game of cheaters, right? And I'm not just talking about the 2017 Astros or the Red Sox or the Yankees. We forget about them. But we had probably the most famous home run in baseball history, the shot heard around the world, we now know was the result of electronic sign stealing. That was in the 50s. We know that Ty Cobb sharpened his spikes. We know all those things happened. It is a game filled with steroid users. Okay? And this is where I could, like, if I wanted to be petty, blast some of my Yankee friends and look at all the World Series you guys won with Reuters. But, I mean, let's be honest. Roger Clemens was a Reuter and also was an Astro. So was Andy Pettit, who I think everybody, generally speaking, likes. But the fact of the matter is he used performance-enhancing drugs. I know it was a little different. Bonds, McGuire, Sosa. The names go on and on and on. It is a game filled with people that were trying to get a competitive edge. Therefore, by definition, violating the integrity of the game. That 86 pennant, I love watching Ken Burns baseball because the only justification I get for feeling okay about that is knowing that, you know, was it Daryl Strawberry who he said slid head first so he wouldn't break the cocaine vial in his back pocket? It's a game filled with, look, domestic abuse cases. I mean, the Astros have one. And Roberto Osuna. And then you have Aroldis Chapman and on and on and on and on. Mike Clevenger. That's right. The voice of the integrity of the game and the little outbreak monkey for the Cleveland Indians, now San Diego Padres, essentially threw his wife and baby out. So we can't pick and choose when the game does and doesn't have integrity. And as fans, we do that. And I get that we get to get away with that, right? We get to have that ability to do that, and it helps us survive what the game is there for, which is to be entertaining. Now, why bring all this up? Why go through this laundry list thing? This isn't another time for me to talk about 2017 and what it means to be an Astros fan of still your 2017 World Series champions. Because what we're going to talk about a lot of this episode today is how Major League Baseball is handling its decision to contract and its decision to manipulate its partner in minor league baseball. We're going to have a guest on to talk about it. Jess and I are going to continue our little thought exercise. But again, I bring up this example. As I record this, it is September 20th. So there's about 10 days left until the end of the agreement between MLB and the MILB. There's been no indication that Major League Baseball has any intention to let the MILB as we know it survive. And quite frankly, particularly with the pandemic, they don't have any reason to. They have all the negotiating power. They make the money, they control the players, and any leverage that might have come from congressional pressure and the mayoral pressure and basically the voice of the taxpayers who built some of these stadiums for MLB that now will be left empty went away with the pandemic. Bigger fish to fry. And so they won. They won. They got what they wanted. We tried our best to help save some of these teams as humble as our efforts were. They won. It seems to me that if you already won, just let them know what's happening. Let those people know that you can start looking for a new job or that you won't be retained or that we don't think we're going to, you know, you're one of the 40 teams that probably won't survive. They know. And so not only, as we're going to hear from a guest, can a team not move forward 2021, but we're going to be attending the Innovator Summit for minor league baseball, which celebrates the end of their year, already a year that was cost by the pandemic. And now it's going to be an event, which is supposed to be a joyous celebration, colored by the fact that they don't know what their future is. And this is just the next example in which Major League Baseball has acted with a distinct lack of integrity towards members of its game. They've done it to players a bunch. They're going to do it to players again. And they are going, now they're doing it to the minor league baseball system. And all of these owners, some of whom are small family owners who just thought to themselves, one day I want to own a baseball team. And they worked to do that. And they provided so much for their communities. So when I say that baseball doesn't have integrity, it's because something that is inherently human made and human run really can't act with 100% integrity. Doesn't mean I love the game any less. Doesn't mean that I'm not sitting through every one of these excruciating Astros performances. It doesn't mean that I'm flipping through my Google Photos any less going, God, I really wish I could get back out to Bismarck for one more ball game or back out to normal. Doesn't mean any of those things aren't true. It just means I'm calling it as I see it. And the fact is that when you want to get on your high horse and talk about this group of people's hurting the sanctity of the game, or this person, this group of people's killing the integrity of the game, you don't know what you're talking about, because the integrity of the game, quite frankly, never existed. And maybe the best thing we can do is move forward with a realization of what baseball is, and then maybe we can get back to enjoying it the way that we used to.
Who's on first? The Let's Get To Local 9. Brought to you by Zoomer Sport.
So we're excited to welcome to the Who's On First segment the general manager of the Greenville Drive, Eric Jurinko. Eric, how's it going, man?
Hanging in there. How about yourself?
Doing the same. I teach film by day, and it was our first week back with students, half of them.
Okay.
So I'm going to have a quick nap as soon as this is over with. I'm dead. You know, I want to talk a little bit about where we are with baseball right now, but a little bit about you. How did you end up getting interested in the game in the first place and end up, you know, working for the Drive?
It's an interesting story, I guess. So this should have been our 15th anniversary season here in Greenville. And I've actually been with the Drive all 15 years.
Oh, wow.
My story kind of, I mean, just like any other kid, when you're growing up, you're playing baseball, play through high school. You know, you have the dream when you're in Little League of becoming a professional baseball player. I actually came to Clemson to play some baseball, but also really started out as an engineering major. Because Clemson is really known for its engineering program. And I'm originally from Philadelphia. So came down to South Carolina. Really, you know, that first year, Clemson flat out tells you, like, your first year in engineering is going to be your hardest. Uh-huh. And it was my second semester of freshman year. I always tell people my schedule was Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 8 a.m. physics, 9 a.m. chemistry, 10 a.m. calculus. And I had like a 3.2 GPA, and I was just like, this is miserable. Just get me out of this. And lucky enough, Clemson started a sports marketing program the very next year. So I transferred into that. And I guess you can say the rest is history. I interned before my final semester with the Bowie Bay Sox, and really loved everything about minor league baseball, just interning with them that year, because it was 2004, and they were hosting the Eastern League All-Star Game, and they had the presidential or the congressional softball game that they host, and they had a pay-per-view boxing match and a WWE event and an Allen Iverson celebrity softball event. So they had all of these things, which is pretty much the definition of minor league baseball and the experiences that go on at the ballparks, and that created my love for this industry. Came down to Greenville, started in Greenville in 06 or late 05 as the media relations director, and really had aspirations of being here 3 or 4 years and going back to Clemson and working in the sports information department, or moving back home to Philadelphia or working for the Phillies or the Eagles in media relations. And the more I dove into the business aspect of minor league baseball, I really loved it and just took on new roles every year. And then 2013, our general manager, who had been with us since the beginning, announced that he was stepping down, leaving sports. He had 4 kids, wanted to spend more time with them. And that really opened up the opportunity for me. Our owner had a lot of faith in me because I was still relatively young at the time, didn't know everything, still don't know everything, but put a lot of faith in me and knew we'd take some lumps probably my first year. But when you have somebody who believes in you and puts the product out that we have in our ownership group, it's been phenomenal.
I'd like to pivot the interview to some of your favorite Troy Aikman memories, but we won't do that to you as an Eagles fan, of course. No, I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, 2020, obviously upsetting to everyone, more upsetting to minor league baseball because of the backdrop of what the landscape is looking like. But before we get into that, just a little bit about what does the Drive, the team, mean to the community?
Yeah. And all the credit in the world for our positioning and our success over the last 15 years goes to our owner, Craig Brown. I mean, when he actually bought the team when they were in Columbia, South Carolina, tried to build a new stadium there back in 04, 05, and that kind of fell through. At the last minute, the Greenville Braves that had been here for 20 years moved to Pearl, Mississippi, which opened up this area. And as our owner will say, he was either smart enough or dumb enough to suggest, because this became a really prime territory, and he was one of 6 ownership groups that were putting in a bid for this area. And he'll say he was either smart enough as a business person or dumb enough because he didn't understand the industry to make the pitch that if the city donated the land in downtown, he would fully fund the stadium 100% with private funds. So that ended up being the winning bid. We were probably one of the first stadiums to be built in downtown, in a downtown area. Downtown Greenville has really expanded down towards us. Greenville's an unbelievable downtown. I mean, I tell friends and family, like, you get the feel of a big city in terms of restaurants and bars. And we have an unbelievable off-Broadway facility here. And
oh, wow.
A huge concert venue that also has a minor league hockey team. And you have us and just this beautiful Main Street that gets a lot of awards, but you don't have the big city feel in terms of the traffic and the clutter and stuff like that. But he wanted our positioning from day one to be, we're going to be part of the fabric of this community of the upstate, which is Greenville, Anderson, Spartanburg, those surrounding counties. And it's really what's allowed us to sustain our success over our first 14 years. You know, we have a 4,500 seat fixed seat ballpark and we average close to 5,000 fans per game.
Wow.
We tackle every game. I mean, we literally, you know, this would be the time of year where we'd be already focused on the 2021 schedule for at least a month and a half now, where really we turn our young sales team loose on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays and say, hey, you guys, you sell as many groups and hospitality into those. And then our leadership group, which is our owner, who's very hands-on, myself, our VP of marketing, VP of ticket sales, and our VP of finance kind of all sit together and say, okay, what community organizations, what groups, what businesses in town align with us in the way that we go to market, and how can they use the ballpark as an extension of their brand and their community endeavors? So we'll have, you know, a prime example is, like I mentioned, because Clemson, this is a prime engineering community. You've got BMW's US headquarters here, Michelin, some other very high-tech companies. So we do a huge night around advanced manufacturing and engineering where we'll get close to 6,000 students and their families here for a game. And all of those companies set up these unbelievable exhibits on the concourse with 3D printers and robotics and drones. And it's funny because I always joke around with our players on those nights because they'll say to me, hey, Eric, how many tickets do we have out for tonight? I'm like, yeah, it's Wednesday night. We've got 6,500 tickets out for tonight. And they're like, that's unbelievable. And then the game happens. And honestly, all the people are on the concourse doing those exhibits. So the players after the game are like, you told us there were 6,500 tickets out. And I was like, yeah, I didn't say they were here to watch you guys.
Oh, that's great. You know, October, we got the first hint of the contraction thing. And I don't know if you guys were on the list, and the list doesn't matter anyway, because they're now not saying who the list is. And that goes to my ultimate issue with it all. There was a lot of fighting back from Congress and stuff, and then COVID hit. How has the reaction, first of all, how did you guys from a front office perspective take the sort of kicking the can down the road when COVID hit to finally finding out your season was canceled?
Yeah, it was tough because honestly, I don't think anyone, even when COVID first hit in March, that anyone had any idea that it was going to turn out the way it has now. Because honestly, you know, we got the word in mid-March that, okay, spring training's kind of shutting down. They're going to keep the major league guys around. They're going to send the minor leaguers home. And then a couple of days later, like, y'all, we're sending the major leaguers home. But still at that point, when you spoke with people, we're like, okay, this is going to be 2 weeks, maybe a month tops that this is going to get delayed. We don't start till mid-April anyway. So maybe, you know, maybe we still start mid-April, or maybe it's 2 weeks, or maybe it's May 1. Then as things started to happen, you're like, okay, maybe May 1's not possible, but June 1 looks realistic. And then maybe June 22nd, because that's when the second half of our season. Then kind of, honestly, it was around mid-June. I mean, we kind of thought it's the starting of June was okay, maybe we're not going to have a season. And as the days went on in June, we were like, man, it just come out and, you know, put the final nail in the coffin. I mean, the major league side hasn't been figured out yet. There's no shot we have a season at this point. And again, I think when you have an owner that is completely bought in on you know, at the end of the day, we're in the business of making memories. It's always somebody's first night at the ballpark. So you want to make sure everyone has a great experience. So you also have to make sure your staff has a great experience. So he was very protective of what our decisions were going to be and how we were going to, you know, furlough staff. Like, our goal was to not furlough anybody. And around mid-June is when we finally said, okay, we can't go through the whole year with a full staff, unfortunately. And we ended up furloughing half our staff, but I think we were one of the last teams to furlough folks. I would say we did it in a really professional manner in that we sat down with every single staff member individually, whether they were being furloughed or retained through this, just to let them know what was going on. We also have worked some things out where those furloughed folks are still in the office one day a week, helping out with some of our non-baseball events and things like that. I will tell people, those 2 days where I had to sit down with literally everyone in the office and we have 30 full-time employees and we had to cut it down to 14, 15. Those 2 days were the hardest days that I've had to go through in my professional career, and I hope to never have to go through it again. Because at the end of the day, while we all respect each other from a business standpoint, we're all doing what's best for the organization. We're around each other so much that inevitably you're going to become friends, or as I like to say, we're one giant dysfunctional family, because some days we want to kill each other. Some days we love each other, but at the end of the day, we all come together to do what's right for the customer.
Right.
So like I said, it was tough. The good news is we have a plan in place to bring each of those folks back no later than February 1 of next year. Hopefully it's sooner than that. Honestly, just getting a 2021 schedule would go a long way in being able to bring folks back. But at the latest, it's going to be February 1, because we have a pretty robust college schedule here. Not that anyone uses our ballpark as their home field.
Right.
But we have 35 high school and college games in the end of February, all through March, and a little bit in April and May when the team's on the road, with our biggest game of those college games being basically our first game. It's the neutral site game between Clemson and the University of South Carolina the first weekend in March. So that game is like no other. Everyone is, you know, watching the game. We've got 8,000 people in the ballpark, and it is all hands on deck.
So you brought up the schedule, and that's actually what prompted me reaching out to you. Is you had a tweet about who had the spring training schedule being out before the minor league schedule on your bingo card for 2020. Yeah. What did you mean by that?
No, it's just, you know, obviously it's just frustrating at the end of the day with everything that we've gone through this year. You know, Major League Baseball has been able to have a season without fans because at the end of the day, they've got the broadcast rights that we don't have and things like that. I mean, Minor League Baseball, our whole business operation is literally butts in seats.
Yeah.
It's the tickets. And I mean, tickets are a great part, but if you sell a lot of tickets and then you have a poor utilization, that's a bad business model, because you need the people to utilize those tickets and show up, because it's merchandise, it's food and beverage, it's all that. And it's just been a rough year. Feels like it's just been like, you know, we're down and out, and as soon as it seems like there's a glimmer of hope, someone comes and kicks us again. And to have it where, you know, to announce spring training without any inclination of when we're going to get a schedule, it is just tough to see. And, you know, and it's not even so much, obviously having a baseball schedule is key. And you referenced it earlier, the cut list. From everything I've seen, we've never been on the cut list. Yeah. We do have such a strong relationship with the Red Sox that, and heck, we've got a Fenway Park replica. So be interesting all of a sudden if we were told, hey, you're a Yankees affiliate and you got a Yankees affiliate playing in an exact replica of Fenway. But I mean, that's not going to happen. Our understanding is we're still going to be a part of the Red Sox organization. Got a great relationship with them. But as far as the schedule, not only knowing, you know, when we're going to have baseball games again, but the fact that we have a pretty growing and successful events operation that we started 4 years ago, and it's an offshoot. It's still under like my leadership under the Greenville Drive umbrella, but for people to understand that the venue is more than just baseball games, we refer to it as West End Events at Fluor Field, because where the ballpark is located, that's called the West End District of Greenville. So we've got a director that leads that. She reports to me. We've got a full-time executive chef that has some unbelievable culinary skills and experience. So, I mean, we're sitting here right now without a schedule for 2021 with folks coming to us saying, hey, we want to have our wedding reception, or we want to have our wedding rehearsal and reception. 2 years ago, we had 55 weddings at our ballpark. And we can sit here and say right now, hey, we don't have a schedule. I know you're looking at April, a Saturday in April. Let's go ahead and say, let's hold back-to-back Saturdays in April. And hopefully we have the schedule by October. Could be December. Hopefully it's no later than that. And once we get that, we'll lock you into the one where we don't have a game. I mean, you deal with brides and you tell them that, they're like, no, we can't wait till October or December.
Brother, I used to shoot weddings.
So the amount of non-game day opportunities that we're losing right now, it's just one thing after another, which is really hard.
How much of it do you think it is the fact that they're just going to run the clock out on the MILB and build something new? I mean, obviously you'll stay affiliated and 120 teams will probably still be back, but there will be 40 that won't have clubs.
Yeah. I don't know. It's been interesting. It's since they formed the new negotiating committee and some of the subcommittees, I guess, that are a part of it. It's stayed a lot more tight-lipped than it seemed. Cause honestly, I told our owner the other day, I said, it seemed like Baseball America was getting information before we were on some stuff that it drove. I mean, I actually signed up for a Baseball America subscription so I could read JJ's articles. Cause I was like, yeah, apparently this is how I'm going to have to find out what's going on. And now it seems that based off of the latest changes to those committees and everything, the information isn't out there as it was before. So I think we're kind of just playing the waiting game and hopeful that everything's going to work out in our favor. But at the same time, until I see something official that's signed by us, whoever we're affiliated with, and Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball, I mean, I guess we're all on pins and needles.
Well, Eric, thanks a lot for jumping on last minute. I can't wait for you to get the schedule out, because we're going to come out to see you guys from Austin, Texas next year. Oh. We are super excited. I'm going to order some gear. We're going to have a great time whenever we know when that will be.
Absolutely.
On deck, the Let's Get To interview, brought to you by Marco Fine Arts.
So we are excited to welcome to our On Deck segment the pride of the Nebraska Cornhuskers and the number 13 pick of the Houston Astros in the 2017 draft, Jake Meyers. Jake, how's it going, man?
It's going well. Just got into Houston and I'm excited. Just had a good season. Excited to get back home and start it all over again.
One of the things I told my wife that we were interviewing you and that you were in Corpus, she wanted to make sure you got to Snoopy. Do you get it to get out and do that type of stuff when you're in training mode?
During a normal season, maybe just a little bit. Yeah. Maybe on off days or you know, if we really want to go out and do something, some of us guys. But during this time, we weren't allowed to do anything. I mean, we just went to the field and back to the hotel, and that was it.
Nothing like playing outside in the middle of a Corpus Christi July. Let's right. go back a bit, though, because I did talk about you being a Nebraska Cornhusker. But you also were a Mystic Schooner, right? How was that whole experience playing collegiate summer league?
I absolutely loved it. I loved my experience up in Mystic. I had a fantastic host family. And I think that, and it was honestly a fantastic experience because of the fantastic coaches and everybody who put that league on. It was just well run and I learned a lot and got a lot better. And I think that's the goal of a summer league.
How important that is that then for like you getting drafted? I mean, because the college game is so different than the pro game. I mean, the bats and all of that stuff. How much does it matter?
I think it's big. And I think that's why it's weighed a lot in drafts. You see a lot of guys out of the Cape Cod League who do really well get drafted early because they're using wood bats and they're going up against the best competition. And it's just tough to get that combination in college baseball all the time. But, you know, you don't necessarily have to be in the Cape Cod to get drafted or whatnot. It's just kind of a easier way to get scouted.
The thing that I always thought was funny about those leagues, because, I mean, you're up from Nebraska, so Northwoods is in that direction. There's a lot of good, but Texas, we don't have any of that that's any good. Like, it's so weird to me.
It is very, very odd that there aren't any, summer baseball leagues for college. I would think there'd be a big one in Texas. Absolutely.
Maybe it's the 175 degrees. Maybe that's
it. Could
that's
be. Why. It could be yeah. that. It could be.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your time in Quad Cities. Were you there as part of the long road trip?
I was not. I was there the year before.
Yeah.
I was there the year before.
I don't know how much you followed, but you know they're kind of on that list to be contracted. You know, and that's kind of the focus of our show is really, we kind of were some of the first ones to start talking about it. And it's kind of every day there's no information, which means we're 9 days away, right? Till that thing ends. Right. Can you just give an idea of what the Quad Cities River Bandits mean to the people in that community?
Oh man. I mean, just as a player, you can tell playing at a place if the community absolutely loves that place. And Quad Cities was on the top of my list of one of the top places that just embraced the Bandits, you know, and everywhere you went, you're asked wearing a Bandit shirt, you know, are you on the team? What position you play? And a lot of great fans around that area. And not only that, we had a ton of, we all lived with host families. So that shows you that they're willing to bring in, you know, baseball players to live with them. And all of us had fantastic experience with each one of them. And they were great people and got to know them, still talk to them. So, I mean, kind of hearing that, you know, it kind of hurts that they want to take away that place. Cause that's honestly, if you ask a lot of Astros players, that they would say that's one of their favorite places that they got to play throughout the organization.
Yeah, it's like as a guy who travels to cover this stuff, like it's not my day job. I'm a filmmaker by profession. So
yeah,
the idea that I missed it because of the flood and now who knows. I actually just missed you last season in Fayetteville. You had just moved up. How cool was it that though to get to go play like inaugural season, brand new ballpark, that whole thing?
Yeah, it was a ton of fun. I mean, talk about another place, another community embracing. I don't think they knew the support they were about to get in Fayetteville. They built a great stadium. I don't think they understood that how much Fayetteville was going to come together and come to all the games. I mean, I think we averaged 2,000 people a game in a beautiful new stadium. It was just coming from Buies Creek to Fayetteville. It was a whole turnaround right there. I mean, Buies Creek was a lot of fun. We just didn't get very many fans. So it was a complete
difference. Yeah. And I got to imagine it's weird because Buies Creek always kind of knew eventually they're going to move. So I had to wonder if that factored in maybe.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
Yeah, no, but we had a great time. I did get to see you play out in Corpus, which is by far my favorite ballpark on the planet. Yeah. Again, getting to be a hook, man. Like what was that whole experience like? I mean, I cannot imagine having to play baseball in that heat, though. Honestly.
Yeah, that was something completely new to me. I mean, I'm used to playing in 100 degree weather, but I'm not used to playing in 100 degree weather with 100% humidity. Yeah. That's a whole new beast. The humidity is, but it. It was a lot of fun. Like you said, the park is top notch. You look out, we were playing baseball the other day and a boat went by, you know, like a really cool boat went by and all the guys were like, oh, that's really cool. You know, just stuff like that is a lot of fun to see and be around. So,
and you know, speaking of host families, Melba says hello.
Yeah. Yeah. She was awesome. Yeah. She housed me in my time in Corpus and that was very, very nice of her.
Yeah, she's actually kind of come on. So it's funny because she's coming on our show too because we've never had, like, I've always wanted to have a host mom on. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you got this big moment in your career. But I want to go back to getting drafted real quick because you were a 13-round pick for the Astros. Yep. I don't know what it's like to be a top level elite athlete. The highest level of baseball I played was in a ballpark we built when I was deployed to Bosnia. That's it.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, our foul balls were surrounded by minefields. It was a whole other experience.
Oh boy.
It was a piece of work. But you know, you get drafted. Like, at what point are you like, cool, I just got drafted, my life's a little different now? And then do you think to yourself, but that organization was still closer to being the one that lost 100 games than knowing what it would become the one that would win 100 games? Like, was there any part of you that was concerned, or you didn't care? You were just like, I'm in the show.
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole draft process is absolute craziness. You're hoping, you know, everybody's hoping they get drafted before they do, except the first pick. It's just how it works. Yeah. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's just an incredible experience to, you know, get drafted by a team and, you know, live out that experience. But I'd say through my experience, I was just super, super happy that the Astros, you know, took a chance on me and drafted me. I kind of knew that they were going to be heading in the right direction. Even just looking at our draft and seeing who they drafted, guys like Jake Adams, JJ Mattejevic, you know, in my draft class, the pitchers as well. I mean, I had played against JJ and Jake in college, and they were unbelievable players. So I could tell that even just from the draft that they were going to do, you know, we were going to have a solid team where I was. And, you know, let alone the big league team, but yeah, you know, it was just a lot of fun to be a part of that. And I was excited anyways. So
you get your big moment, you get to go to your first spring training, which I have to think is got to be like a rush of like excitement and nerves and you want to do well. And I actually found the video of you getting hit by the pitch and Robert Ford going, that doesn't feel great, but you know, no. You did show up. Like, how were you able to channel out the fact that you did get probably, I'm assuming you got a little heckled because of things you had nothing to do with. And
yeah,
my listeners are tired of me talking about that particular subject, but blocking it out, or did it bug you at all? Or did you even notice?
I'm going to be honest. I had no idea what was going on. I got hit and I was running to first base. That's all.
Yeah.
Like, when I'm in the game, I'm not thinking about much. I knew I had nothing to do with it. So there wasn't much thought put into it.
Oh, that's good. And then to see it get shut down with COVID, right? So what was that experience like for you? I mean, you had to have been like we talked to a different situation, but Ryan Hernandez, who plays for University of Houston, you know, you played 14 games and then he's back home. How did that go for you?
Yeah, I mean, kind of getting all amped up for the spring training. I got the chance to play in a couple of the big league games and get a couple games under my belt. And then all of a sudden the season's off, like you said. And so it's just a completely different mindset that you had to take into the quarantine, and you had no clue. There was a ton of uncertainty if you even get a play again. And so kind of just shaping, you know, what your day was like was super important for me, just trying to stay ready mentally and physically for if there was a season. And I got the opportunity to be a part of the 60 man. And it was honestly a great experience for me. I got a lot better, learned a lot. And so it was just a good year around for me. I would have wished to play, but
yeah,
it is what it is.
Well, but the 60 man had to have been really great though, because you really were, I mean, you could have been called up at any moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could have been called up, but it didn't end up happening, but I got to work with some fantastic coaches and get a lot of reps against some great pitchers and other players. So,
yeah, I think one of the guys that you played with that caught everybody's eye was Enoli Paredes. Was it kind of cool to see him, do well?
Yeah, he's a stud. I mean, I got the chance to play with him for 2 years, you know, with him each team all the way up, and he kept going, obviously. But he is a special player. He's got a unbelievable personality. He's just bouncing off the walls, and he's going to do really, really well. As you can see, he already has, but he just, you know, he's dominant every time he goes out on the mound.
right. So now you're about to head back to Nebraska. Thanks for jumping on, by the way, through a hurricane, no less, or a tropical storm. Yeah. We should joke about hurricanes in Houston, Texas. But how are you, so what are you going to do off season? Focus on there. You personal life stuff. I'm guessing you're going to keep getting ready.
Yeah. I'm going back to Nebraska. I'm going to take a little time off and then, you know, get back to it and really just try and focus on getting bigger, stronger and getting better all around.
Well, Jake, thanks so much for jumping on. We'll let you get ready for your flight. But the promise is next year I'm coming to spring. So here's the story. My birthday present was my first trip. I grew up in the Astrodome, man. My birthday present was my first trip to spring training.
Okay.
Got shut down 2 days before
fly out. Oh, man.
So we're coming next year. You got to do an in-person interview with me. Deal?
Sounds good.
This just in. News from Minor League Baseball.
So we do have some breaking news on the show, and we're going to start in the minor league baseball world, the affiliated minor league baseball world. And, you know, that is the focus of our show, and it will definitely continue to be the main primary focus as we move toward getting an idea of what the 2021 and beyond seasons are going to look like for affiliated minor league baseball. But it does look like that the instructional leagues in Arizona are going to get together and play. So essentially, the teams that have spring training facilities in Arizona, all 15 of them, have agreed to play games, minor leaguers versus minor leaguers. The games will start somewhere near the beginning of October and will end usually around mid-November. Unlike in previous years, instructional league players weren't always paid. This year they will be. So for some of the minor leaguers who had been dealing with the pandemic like everybody else, it at least means another month or so of paychecks. So that's always good news for those players. Still waiting for a lot of word on this, whether fans will be allowed, that kind of thing. Hopefully we'll get some clearance. Still waiting for a lot of news on this. For example, whether fans will be allowed. Hopefully we'll get some more information on this coming soon. Because if there's an opportunity to go to see some baseball in Arizona, you know which podcast / web series will be there. Like, the nature of this show has always been baseball from the fan perspective. And this year, particularly if you think about the team that I got on the front of my shirt, it's been hard to keep that in focus. I'm not going to lie. It's been really hard to remember that I started the show with a mission and that I need to stick to that mission regardless of the outside noise. And one of the central tenets of our show is and always will be positivity. Baseball, look, whether we want to admit it or not, baseball has a problem, and it's a fan problem. And the fan problem that our friends at Before the Pitch have pointed out before is that baseball fans aren't getting any younger. Everybody's talking about this. And, you know, one of the things that I want to be able to do is in my own little sphere of influence is hopefully find a way that we can all interact with our teams, but with fans of other teams positively. And even though, again, I have taken the brunt of negativity because of who I choose to follow, you know, it's not going to change who I am. And so I think one of the best ways of expressing that, and I think one of the best ways of really moving past the negativity, is just to be out and out positive. And so, you know, one of the things, the way I'm built, is when something good happens for one of my friends or some of my friends, I'm legitimately excited and happy for them. And so I'm going to, you know, I want to congratulate a bunch of my friends who have reason to celebrate, who have seen their teams clinch the playoffs. You know, the Astros are close. Hopefully 2020 doesn't happen, and they do, but it's got to mean a lot. And even though the season has been weird, to get that moment of positivity, that's got to be pretty awesome. Now, the Tampa Bay Rays have clinched. And I don't have any friends that are Tampa Bay Rays fans because I'm not sure they're... See, I was going to make a Tampa Bay Rays fan joke, but I stopped myself because I'm learning to be better. The Yankees have clinched a playoff spot. And, you know, we want to really congratulate and celebrate and I guess congratulate's weird, but just really be really happy for friends of the show, the guys at the Scotty Before the Pitch, the Hitter Sports, Emily Nyman, Miss Steal Your Base, Spencer, the New York Yankee hat guy, all of our Yankee friends, Chicago White Sox are in the playoffs. And I can't help but think of my cousin Brendan, who's worked on so many films with me and has been part of our film festival and is just the guy comes down from Wisconsin all the time and works really, really hard. And of course, my cousin Colleen and my aunt Jean and who are all big White Sox fans. So again, happy for them. The Minnesota Twins have clinched. And of course, we are now referring to them as the Fightin' Andrew Nelson. So congratulations. And of course, the Oakland Athletics have clinched. And look, beyond Stu Clary being a part of this show and being one of the best people I've ever met, but the fact is that's a region of the country that's in a lot of pain. And, you know, when you talk about 17 and why a lot of Astros fans maybe don't care as much as they should about what went down, it's because of what that meant in the backdrop of losing everything. And so that has to apply to the folks up there in Oakland. So we're very excited for all of them. We're very excited for 10 stadiums, 10 days. All those guys, we'll get them tagged on Twitter. But yeah, we're happy for them. Congratulations. Again, making the playoffs is so cool. And then finally, we already did a shout out to them on Twitter, but to our friends Friars on the Farm and Megan Ellis, your Padres have made the playoffs first time in since 2006. And one of the cool things about that is I was listening to the play-by-play because the Padres radio voice is one of the best in the business. And when he did the, my Padres are going to the playoffs, I got a little chill, man. That is what baseball is about. It's about this promise. And it's about the distraction of everything that's bad in the world. So to all my friends who follow the Padres and the Dodgers and the Athletics and the Twins and the White Sox and the Yankees and the Rays, really heartfelt, very happy for y'all because we all need a little positivity in this time when there's not a whole lot to be positive about.
The Minor League Mind with Jess Canaster.
So we are back here on the Minor League Mind with Jess Canaster, and we are continuing our thought exercise about the demise of that once beloved minor league baseball team, the Padre Island Pirates. And Jess, you know, last time we talked about the economic impact and the ancillary economic impact. Let's talk a little bit about what else is lost when a team is up and gone.
Well, I think, first and foremost, obviously, it's an attraction. It's something to do. We mentioned last week the existence of bars and restaurants and things nearby to the ballpark to really make a 3-hour sporting event or a 2 to 3 hour sporting event into a kind of a whole day affair. But I think the immediate thing is you lose the aspect of something to do in the summertime, and it can be from the season ticket holders who are at every single game, who are either retired or with young children who don't yet go to school or some combination of that, or people who are still of working age but find a way to make it to every game or every Friday, Saturday, Sunday game or make it to a vast majority of the games. That's obviously the extreme, the people who are at every game and now have nothing to do for 77.
I was under the impression there would be no math on this episode.
That's how I try to live.
Yeah.
But at least 70 games a year, 70 days a year, they have something to do. They have somewhere to go. They have a whole social circle of friends who sit with them at baseball games. And really, it's no different than families who have season tickets anywhere. You have season tickets in your same spot and you get to know the people who sit around you. You get to know the people who have various idiosyncrasies at the ballpark. And now that is lost. And you have to see if you want to see those people, you have to find some other way to see them, yeah, which might be easier done in some situations than others. So that's obviously the first thing that gets lost.
One of the things that hit me when I was thinking about this was a sense of community. So our local team is Round Rock, and Round Rock is essentially Austin. That's a big city. But one of the things that really hit me is when I went and met you for the first time in Midland, and how you had a town, which it's a pretty big town. Midland's grown, built around one industry, with a ball team and ballpark that revolves around that one industry. And that's all the same thing in Normal with the Corn Belters. How is that part of the community really reflected and therefore impacted in these teams?
Well, I think, you get outside of big cities. And this I've gotten the opportunity to experience firsthand several times growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area with 6-ish million people. Pro sports dominates. They dominate the headlines. They dominate conversation. They dominate leisure money. At all levels, pro sports, and at the top level, pro sports dominate, because minor league baseball is still professional baseball. They don't get paid very much, but they still get paid. Usually it falls under the level of professional. So, but like college sports and high level sports, I mean, the Bay Area is home to, at least recently, up until recently, one of the best high school football teams in the country in De La Salle, up near Oakland. And those sports just don't get any coverage. They don't get any play at the national level, or even really at more than just the basic community level. And so when you move to smaller communities, and a place like Midland is still, you know, a pretty good sized area, Midland and Odessa, about 350,000-ish people in that metro area. That's a good sized metro area. And what happens with the Rockhounds, what happens with high school sports and local area college sports, that's front page news. That's stuff that people are talking about. The grocery stores are talking about it at the bars. When the Little League team went to, in Midland, went to the Little League World Series or was working their way through.
Yeah.
Everybody was talking about it. You go into a Buffalo Wild Wings or any sort of major sports bar, it's on every single television. And if you want something else on TV, you have to ask for it. And so when you move into these smaller areas and you look at these smaller areas, this is a, you know, these are teams that have the city name or the regional name on their shirts, on their jerseys. And so the names on the back, it really is one of those things where you play for the name on the front, but not the back, but the community cheers for the name on the front. And in most cases, minor league jerseys don't have names on the back because they move so much. But
go ahead.
That's your identity. This is the local ball club. When I want to go watch fireworks, when I want to go do anything, go cheer for the local nine because everybody's got one.
And the key being local. One of the things I wanted to bring up was we had on last season, the Binghamton Rumble Ponies owner. And here's a team that was thought to be on the contraction list and then said they weren't. Now we don't know. But the idea of them losing their ball team was really more impactful because they've already lost IBM. They are already economically depressed. What can a baseball team do when we're, because I mean, again, let's go use the Midland example. We both know that economy does this. There can be steaks on the grill one day and hot dogs on the grill the next day based on the price of oil. What can a ball team do for people to keep them kind of maybe distracted so they can keep moving forward?
Well, I think that's one of the things, you know, not attempting to get political, but I think that's one of the things you're seeing push back now with athletes speaking out about things is people use sports as an escape. It's you know, the price of oil is down or the factory is closing or whatever it may be, extenuating circumstances. Baseball and sports in general have often been the opportunity to check that whatever at the door,
yeah,
and be able to come inside, drink a $1 or $2 beer on a Thirsty Thursday, or a $1 hot dog or a 50-cent hot dog on a Wiener Wednesday, something along those lines, and just for 2 to 3 hours watch kids push tires down the right field line with a stick, or watch the mascots go in a race around the foul warning track.
Yeah.
It's something to kind of blank your mind. But then, of course, you know, going back to the community aspect, which I think is probably the biggest deal of all this, at least to me, having been in several different smaller communities and seeing how important it is to the adults as it's a place to gather after work, to the kids as it's a place that can be used as a bribe to get away from home. You get good grades, we'll go to the ballpark and you can get a bucket of helmet nachos. You know, it's your own, and it's each community's own place. And so to not have that for, you know, everybody uses a ballpark and uses a team for their own reasons and to fill their own necessities and fill their own, I don't want to say gaps, but everybody uses a trip to the ballpark for their own purposes.
Right.
And to not have that there means that people need to find other mediums to be able to do whatever it is or get whatever out of a visit to the ballpark. They now have to get that out doing something else. And it just becomes harder, I think, to live, you know, you lose that escape. And so however you choose or however you're able to pick that escape back up, that's something that will get done. But, you know, and then kind of relating forward to what else this can mean for the community is you take professional baseball, even a low-level professional baseball, out of a community, I think you lose baseball. You lose baseball as an outlet, and you start to lose the thought of baseball being something that kids can do growing up.
Okay, let's get there. Let me stop you to reintroduce that concept, because it is where I want to wrap up. Baseball is we've talked about this before, you and I. Baseball is a sport that you and I both love, but is losing fans. And more importantly, it is losing fans of people younger than you and I are. What is the role of the minor league ball team, both for the future of the fans of the sport, but also the future players of the sport?
Well, from the fan aspect, you know, everything that's been talked about prior kind of comes back together, because, you know, I think there really is among kids, there's a sense of wonderment about going to a professional sporting event. And it can be for multiple reasons. It can be for the obvious reasons of you're watching guys, many of which will go on to play in the major leagues, and you're seeing them before they're playing in the major leagues. And, you know, in most cases, you're living in an area where you have access to them, you know, like the Padre Island Pirates. I'm not best at Texas geography, so I apologize, but you're probably what, about 3 hours from Houston?
Yeah, about that. Yeah. Yeah. No, so, actually, no, farther than that, but you're within driving distance. Yes.
So yeah, you know, and a kid who wants to go to a baseball game, chances are he's probably going to get to go to, he or she is going to get to go to 10 times as many local games, Pirates games, as going to Houston. That might be a once a year trip,
yeah.
But especially if you're traveling and it's not a one day. I mean, I know Texas is all big on the super long road trips. If it's within state boundaries, you can do it. But most places, if you're driving 3+ hours in a day to get one place, that's where you are. You're going to spend the night, so you need a hotel, you need all this extra stuff, and it's not the same as let's go down to the local ball field five times down the road. You don't have to pay for parking because that's how it works, and then we get to sleep in our own beds, and we could probably see 3 games for the amount of time and the amount of money, at least, that it would take to go to a major league game. And so from a fan aspect for kids, you lose that sense of access to the players who are right there, to the mascots who are right there. Certainly you lose the access to go to as many games. If you still are interested in going to baseball games, it becomes more expensive for your family to do. And so you probably just don't end up doing it. And then from a developmental standpoint, I think you see a lot of kids and a lot of adults or a lot of pro players in the States, a lot of guys in the majors, and even in Canada, who grew up going to minor league games. It was a place that they first saw minor baseball players in person. You know, these guys are at least 20 years old, 18 to 20 years old. So to a 6 or 7 year old, they're big, they're grown. And so it's inspiration for them. It's, oh, you know, I could go on to become a baseball player, and I enjoy Little League so much. This is what my future is. And you take that away from them, they can still see what their future could be, but they have to do it on television or potentially go on a multi-hour car ride or airplane trip to get to that place. And so I don't think it will kill the development of future baseball players, but certainly I think little leaguers are inspired by going to see somebody older than them play baseball. And
you know, I think it's one of the things that you're saying, that
you lose that chance.
One of the things that's interesting about that also as well is, you know, the teams that are going to lose, that are going to lose these teams, these 40 teams, you know, and I, and I've talked to GMs of some of these teams, and they hope that Major League Baseball will keep their promise about helping collegiate summer grow in those areas. I don't think they will. I'm sorry, I don't trust them as far as I can throw them, and I'm out of shape. But what I would say is, you know, if you look at the towns that are thinking about losing, that are being considered to lose their teams, they're smaller areas, they're rural, they're short season, the Appalachian League, they're of a certain economic demographic. And then we've also talked with Darian Sills-Evans on the show about how baseball has also started to ignore the poor Black community in cities. It's really becoming an elite white, or if you're from the Dominican Republic or other Latin American countries, type of sport.
Yeah, I think there really is. I mean, with what Major League Baseball wants to do, it's very clear that their goal is, how can we make money off of minor league baseball in the future? And, you know, that sounds probably a little rougher than it should be, because pro sports is a business. Yep. But at the same time, minor league baseball in all of these communities finds ways to reach out to all demographics pretty well. You know, anybody can afford a free ticket, and most teams have free ticket or free food or free drink nights. There's a couple teams in the California League that do a nothing night, or have done a nothing night, where the gates are open. The concessions are closed. There's no music. There's no anybody. You can bring your own food into the ballpark that you had at home, or that you picked up at a restaurant or whatever. And you come in and you sit down and you watch the baseball game. And that's what there is. So there really is, I think, that community outreach, because minor league teams recognize, and really because there is no overlying checkbook that will help keep the team afloat if they're not making money locally, that there is that emphasis on making money but also being part of the community and really connecting with your members of the community, because you never know how it will help you in the future. You know, certainly there are kids who grew up underprivileged and found a way into sports, baseball certainly one of them, and now play at a high level, if not the major leagues or some other top professional level. And so, you know, it goes back to, it's all so interconnected that you don't know what people are going to be in the future, but if you write them out of the present, then you know that they won't be a part of that future.
Raiders of the Lost Diamond, a look into baseball's past.
So we're back on Raiders of the Lost Diamond, and something dawned on me when we were recording our segment with Jess Canaster. We were talking about the fictional Padre Island Pirates when I realized there already were pirates that played baseball on the Texas Gulf Coast. Now, the Texas Gulf Coast, the pirate thing is big everywhere. And I think the thing people need to realize, it's actually one of the longest coastlines of any state in the Union. I think second, maybe only like California and Alaska. And the pirate legacy is really, really rich there. You've got Galveston, you've got South Padre Island, which we mentioned, you've got Port Aransas, which is where I kind of go when I want to go to the beach. But back to Galveston, the pirate legacy is huge, and there was a team called the Galveston Island Pirates. So Galveston was my other summer playground. If it was not the Astrodome, we were going to the beach. It was about 40 minutes from my house. And, you know, people like to crap on the Texas Gulf Coast, but I think it's awesome. The water is always warm. People think it's dirty, but it's really not. It's got everything to do with the way the mud churns up, but it's not like polluted. And again, soft sand beaches, the water was always temperate. It was always nice to get in. It was always a big part of my childhood. I actually remember my uncle used to come over to our houses when I was, you know, like 11:30 at night, when I was like five or six, already in bed. mom had finally settled this in, and he would just kind of come in. This is her younger brother, and would yell, "Let's go to the beach," and we'd get real excited, and then he would leave. But baseball used to go to the beach on Galveston Island, actually dating back as far as the 1880s. So you had the Galveston Pirates. They were a Texas League team that played from 1912 to 1917 and then from 1919 to 1921. Now, Galveston, again, one of the key spots on America's third coast, also played host to the Galveston Buccaneers, the Galveston Whitecaps, and the Galveston Sandcrabs, and that's the team that dates back to the 1880s. Galveston played at Beach Park, which featured the fastest game in Texas League history at 49 minutes. There was apparently a threat of massive storm, as happens in Galveston. 49 minutes, and they needed none of the dumb pace of play rules that Rob Manfred has been putting into play in Major League Baseball. They played at Pirate Field, and they played at Gulfview Park. Now, as far as notable alums, there actually weren't many. In fact, the only one I really found of note played for the Galveston Whitecaps, and that was Harry Brechin. And really what grabbed me was the fact that he is a Hall of Famer who played for the Cardinals. Now, the connection to the Cardinals is interesting because long before the Astros came to town in the 1960s, Houston's baseball team was the Buffaloes, the longtime AA affiliate for the St. Louis Cardinals before they eventually became the AAA club for the Cubs and then eventually were replaced by the Houston Colt 45s. Now, also of note for the Galveston Pirates was a Negro League team known as the Galveston Black Pirates. Now, not a lot of information I was able to find in time for the episode, but I just thought it interesting again that the Negro League would essentially take the moniker of the team also in town for white players and just add the black to it. So it wasn't just our fictional Padre Island Pirates that were riding the waves of baseball's Gulf Coast, but we also had the Galveston Pirates and the Galveston Black Pirates lost beneath the waves of history like so much of John Lafitte's buried treasure.
And now on to close it out, the right-hander from Houston, Texas, James Christopher.
So that does wrap us up for this episode of Let's Get To. We have another great episode coming up this week. We're going to be talking to a baseball host mom. And I'm so excited because this is like, you know, I talked about the opening about how baseball maybe lacks integrity as an institution. And again, stand by that. But it doesn't mean it's not made up by beautiful people, even those that are like tangentially connected to the game that love baseball so much and love players that they do their best to go out of their way to help those players. So I'm very excited to talk to them. We're going to have Andy back, Scott back as we now round into the final weekend, so weird to say, of the regular season. So I hope that you all enjoy your week. I hope that if your team is in contention, that they keep the push going. I do want to say to all of the Toronto Blue Jays fans out there, including my best friend Mike Donis, those are the best uniforms in baseball. Those baby blues with the dark blue and the light blue cap lip, those are the best. So I know that it's been a rough go. The Yankees kind of put football scores on you, but you still are probably in the playoffs and you get to look at those uniforms. So there's nothing wrong with that. So until next time on Friday, let's get to.